Yes, hello, this is Danhausen here, very nice for evil, and you are listening to Bob After Dark. Subscribe or be cursed.
From Mothman and Nessie to the spirit that haunts your home, welcome to Bob After Dark, a podcast about legends, lore, and the supernatural. So turn your lights down and your volume up and enjoy your trip to the shadows.
Hey there, children of the night, and welcome to Bob After Dark, the show that takes you into the shadows and goes and says hello, everything that goes bump in the night. I'm your host with the most that enjoys toast, Bob, and alongside of me, as always, is my ever wonderful, ever vampiric, ever not cape wearing because it's too warm, The heartthrob of Bob After Dark, my friend, my brother, my producer, Companic himself. Oh, hey there, Companic.
Hi there, Bob. I'm sorry, I'm paying attention to YouTube as well. Halo Art. Art is in the chat as well. Lights, camera, action. So Art chiming in along with Heather. Good to see you, Bob.
Good
as
to see
always,
Companic, as always. Yes.
Yes.
You know, I needed to point something out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that this is the first week of season two that we don't have a guest. We have a guest, but it's not like a guest.
Well, now he's mad.
Oh.
You insulted him.
But it's not like, how do I say, Chuck's like a regular on the show. We get Chuck.
A correspondent.
Chuck is a correspondent of WJOB. Yes. He's like a co-worker.
Yeah.
But we don't have like.
Like an esteemed guest.
Now you made him mad.
No. Chuck will be on with us here soon.
Soon, yeah.
Tech gods provided that the sound works all fine here. But you're talking about like a guest that has nothing, that doesn't correspond with us usually.
Yes. So this is we are doing a classic episode. So if this is your first time ever watching or listening to an episode of Bob After Dark, we are your weekly show where we talk about legends, lore, and the supernatural, things that go bump in the night, lights in the sky, weird cryptid stories, and of course, Count Panic's favorite cryptid that's not Nessie or Bigfoot.
I think you could probably think of something.
What?
The pants, man-eating gourd.
Oh, the man-eating gourd. Yeah. Good answer.
I think you asked me that before.
I'm sure I've asked you that before. I blank this week. I'm half asleep.
Are you sleeping?
I'm not sleeping. I'm wide awake. Just tired.
Glomper says Art, and Chuck loves paying taxes. Also,
all right.
Also, Vix is chiming in. When I hear Chuck, it's the special surprise guest. Vixis is fired up about Chuck.
Yeah, we're excited to have Chuck on the show. All right, so
there are Zoom ghosts.
Before we get Chuck on the show, there is a segment on Bob After Dark that we used to do back in season one. We haven't done it in season two, but I have to give somebody a shout out.
Sure.
Do you remember we did the weird spooky news of the week, Count Panic?
The weird spooky news of the week. Do you see what's going on? You can't see it on this. I could see him doing that, but he can't see it.
What's that?
Chuck's just over there chilling.
Oh, okay. We'll get Chuck on air very soon.
I know.
But the weird spooky news of the week, that's where you, the fans, and me, the Bob, go scouring the internet for the weird and unusual hitting headlines.
Yeah.
That's anywhere from, like, ghost or cryptid sightings making it into major media, aliens exist type of news reports, or advances in science that borderline on science fiction. Half of these stories, if not more, come from one person.
Who?
Tim Banal.
Oh, Tim Banal.
Our old pal Tim Banal. And it's funny because I actually had a correspondence.
Really?
With Tim Banal.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really cool thing. I reached out to him on Facebook. I can say that we're friends on Facebook.
How about that?
And I sent Tim a message saying, back when I would do this segment on my show from time to time, which from time to time we did this like every week, it's like more than half of my articles I got used to come from you. So thanks for keeping that part of my show alive. And he was very nice about it. He said, thank you. He said he was very humbled. And he wants to come on Bob After Dark someday.
How about that?
That's pretty amazing.
The guy
so
inspired to do.
Yeah, he inspired. He legitimately writes this segment for us. So, in celebration of Tim Banal, all three news stories this week come to us Tim Banal. But first, we have a guest to say hello to, right?
No, go ahead. He's setting up there. Go ahead.
Oh, he's setting up. Yeah. Okay, we'll say hi to Chuck here in a moment.
I see him. He's decorating.
All right, but thank you so much, Tim Banal, for getting back to me and. Not, you know, all these years, I always imagined this this guy finding me on the internet, like tailgate, like writing his coattails, because you know he writes for Coast to Coast AM, and he's like,
he
this
for us now,
yeah, he writes.
Are we just taking?
But it, so. I come to find out, no, he's the sweetest guy, and I couldn't be more grateful that he was able to correspond with us. Yeah. Okay, sorry about that. My hair is flying in the wind, apparently.
Did you just notice yourself?
Yeah, I guess. Oh, no, Vix was helping me out. Oh. All right, so let's start off. Our first news article comes to us today, again, from Tim Banal, Coast to Coast. British farmer dismayed by latest crop circle. A British farmer was understandably dismayed that his property was chosen as the proverbial canvas for the latest crop circle. Found early last week in Wiltshire, the fourth formation of the season garnered rave reviews from researchers and fans of phenomena for its rather elaborate design. That said, not everyone was thrilled with the newly discovered crop circle, as the unnamed property owner reportedly decried the criminal damage that cost him hundreds of pounds. Hoping to prevent further losses from people carelessly trapezing through the field to see the formation, the farmer promptly mowed over the design and effectively erased it a few days after it was discovered. The landowner's irritation was echoed by Peter Shellcross, chair of the National Farmers Union in Wiltshire, who described the phenomena as troublesome to the BBC. "It's very difficult to harvest a crop when it's on the ground," he explained. "It won't mature properly." In recent years, concentration over crop circles has become as much part of the annual season as the formations themselves, with authorities issuing warnings to the public about illegally making designs in 2017, 2014, and again last year, 2024, and again last year. Farmers also made headlines by rightfully complaining about those costly creations to the media. Nonetheless, much to the charging of police and by property owners, the formations continue to be found year after year, with those who are responsible for the crop circles, whether they be human or alien, managing avoiding being caught. Hashtag for the first time in season two, panic steak.
I'm going to tell you about crop circles, but I'm also going to bring in Chuck here too, because I want to make sure it works.
Yeah, that would make sense.
We might as well have him here. So we have a historian, local historian, and a commentator at WGLB.
Historian and no one.
I could hear you.
Persona non grata.
It's great that I could hear you.
Hey, Chuck, how are you?
Yeah.
I'm good. What a tremendous introduction.
Hold on. Now let me see if the camera works.
You just turned off the TV. There you go.
Hold on.
Too loud, let me know.
I can see Chuck in the camera now. You know, there's a new switcher here now?
Yeah, there is. I bought it. I installed it. So, yeah, I didn't know about that.
Two is Bob and four is you.
Okay. Yeah, and then
correct.
You can't. And yep. Which camera you. Are you?
I'll find myself.
We don't need him. He's good.
Plumber guy saying, "I hope someday Jeb will realize WJB needs to return to 24/7 like it used to be."
Can we?
We gotta tell Chuck to make it 24/7.
Yeah, no, that was fun. You know, when I was a kid, there'd be times I couldn't sleep, and I'd turn on my transistor radio, and like at 3 a.m, there was like the three, just like today, there's like three people that would call in, and they would just have conversations. I think the host would like doze off and just let them talk amongst themselves. So it was good times. And occasionally somebody would try to sell a birdcage or whatever on Bargain Bonanza.
Well, if you want to sell your birdcage here, you can. But back to the crop circles there, Bob.
We'll get your take, and we'll get Chuck's take as
you
well.
Know, crop circles, of course, I seen a movie recently. This has to do with crop circles.
Did you see it?
The Disclosure Day.
Yeah, Disclosure Day. You've seen it?
I've seen it.
What'd you think?
Spoilers. It was okay. I mean, it was kind of long. A lot going on in it. Maybe didn't need everything. It was just fine. But, you know, they had to deal with some crop circles in there. And the funny part of that movie, I don't know if you caught this, Bob, but there's, you know, some old images that are revealed, and one of them is of Nixon greeting somebody saying, oh, yeah, he's showing this popular comedian in the 50s. He's with some popular comedian from the 1950s. We don't know who that was.
We do. It was Jackie Gleason.
That's what I was going to say, because didn't you reference on the show here last
time?
Yes,
we talked
Richard
about
Richard Nixon
that.
Showed Jackie Gleason Aliens. Yep. So that was fun. Not a spoiler, because that's documented, but how about that, Bob?
Interesting stuff.
And crop circles were in that movie. I don't know if you want to get Chuck's take, too, as well.
Chuck's take. Chuck, how do you feel about the crop circle popping up in the UK?
You know, it's funny because, you know, I don't know if you remember years and years ago, those two guys had the wooden stick, and they're like, hey, look what we can do. And then, you know, 4 days later, they were still like halfway through making the circle. So, I mean, again, it's like the only people that have ever come forward and said, hey, we made the crop circles could never replicate even a simple circle. And, you know, obviously, if you know a lot about crop circles, a lot of them, you know, there's microscopic or microcellular changes to where they were bent and stuff like that. There's, I mean, it's not something where you just walk through there with a board and make them. So, I mean, again, it's an interesting thing that no one's been able to, it's like one of those things. Nobody's been able to explain it. So, you know, it is what it is at this point. Until somebody can show us otherwise. You know, you have to believe it's something supernatural or extraterrestrial.
And Vixis chime in, I'm scared to see that movie, and I have a crop circle tattoo.
Yes, she does.
Did you know this, Bob?
I did know that.
Okay.
I actually did. So I actually started watching the Bob Lazar movie the other night. Have you guys watched that at all?
I did not.
The S4. So the S4 movie is really interesting because it's basically the entire film is using 3D modeling. It's basically like a virtual reality of the S4 site, which is a few miles away from Area 51. And it's basically Bob telling the story using this, you know, sort of AI, not even AI, just sort of like this 3D rendering, like a holodeck of S4. So it was really interesting. And to hear the backstory on how that was created is super interesting. But, you know, again, same idea. Here's a guy that you can say what you want about him. You know, here's a guy that remembers all these details about this place that people say doesn't exist, but even like right down to like the posters on the wall and where the doors are and stuff like that, he's been able to like tell them, you know, what this place looked like. So interesting movie if you haven't seen it.
It's on my list. I've been wanting to see it. Kyle Panic's back, by the way. He had to disappear for a moment. We had a visitor in the studio.
Andrew Garcia.
Oh.
Yes. This actually kind of scared me. I looked over and there was a head poking around the corner.
He wanted Chuck's drinking on film, I think. He wanted the thing that was making the phone call thing not work.
Tell him next time he does that, he's going to hear from me. I was about to send a strongly worded text message.
Now let me see if I can pull back the phone. The lines back up here. There's always something going on, Bob. It's tough being a producer.
All right, Cal. What was your take on the crop circle? You didn't give us your take.
I think it's real, Bob. Don't mess with crop circles. That's a
good talk.
Yeah. Hold on. Let me get the phone lines back up here. By the way, the phone lines are open, right,
219-845-1100. You can call in and say hello and tell us your spooky tale.
I found them right here. Yep.
Yes. All right. You ready to move on here, Count?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So our second story comes to us once again from Tim. A Malaysian paranormal vlogger mysteriously disappears during live ghost hunt. A Malaysian paranormal vlogger gave his followers quite the scare when he disappeared during a live ghost hunt and was discovered more than a day later under rather unusual circumstances. The curious case reportedly began on Friday evening as the unnamed content creator was investigating the purportedly haunted, I'm going to butcher this, the Malacca Botanical Gardens in the community of Ayer Kuro. After around 30 minutes, the ghost hunter's live stream abruptly ended, and when the vlogger's broadcast did not resume that evening and attempts to contact him proved futile, his friends and fans understandably feared for his safety. Authorities were eventually alerted to the worrisome situation on Sunday afternoon, which sparked a sizable search for the missing man. After looking for around 3 hours, the ghost hunter was located in a restroom at the nearby Skytrax Adventure Macala tourist attraction. Strangely, the vlogger was said to be in such a weak condition that he had to be taken to the hospital for medical treatment and provided no explanation for what he had seen for the past 40-plus hours. While authorities indicated that they are investigating the peculiar incident, more than a few people on the Malaysian social media have raised suspicions about the weird turn of events. As one might imagine, many have speculated the content creator's disappearance was a hoax, with one observer musing that it could have been a viral marketing campaign for his live streams, and another outright declaring that the incident was, and I quote, a stunt. To that end, some have noted that the Malacca Botanical Gardens is generally not a location where one might get lost, especially for more than a day, which further fueled doubts surrounding the case. That said, if the content creator did fake his disappearance for online clout, it may wind up backfiring him as there are calls for authorities to punish him for wasting police resources and the suspicious and be true. Hashtag panics take.
Yeah, well, we live in a day and age of influencers, Bob. So a lot of times, say, it's like any show, right? You watch these ghost shows, these Bigfoot shows. And you don't find anything. It's just you feel like you got your money's didn't get your money's worth. But then you have these people that might just fake some stuff, and it gets crazy views and hits, as the kids say. And well, then they're off to the races. But you know, that's the day people are doing for clout, is what they say, Bob. So a lot of fake stuff out there.
Hashtag Chuck's take.
You know, I think it's a stunt, but also the fact that you're talking about it all the way here in the United States shows that it worked. So you know what we should do is we should do a ghost hunt sometime and make Count Panic disappear.
For real?
And then he'll show up at a McDonald's like 3 weeks later.
Where have you been? I've been around.
I've been around. Yeah. I could do that.
I got, you know, I'm not going to say it's fake or not because I'm not in the business to, you know, upset some Malaysian paranormal vlogger that probably has way more followers than I do. So I'm not in the market for that, but I will say it's interesting that, you know, the story got attention from Coast to Coast AM, so it had to have done something right. But if it was a stunt or a hoax and they legitimately wasted police, like, you know, authorities' time and effort on their on this, is a rather interesting prank to do. You know what I'm saying? Now, if it was a viral campaign for like a movie and they were not alerting the police in time or whatever it might be, that would be a dangerous situation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. But don't fake your own.
Don't fake your disappearance if you're a paranormal vlogger. However, if that's what it takes, Count Panic.
You want to? That's what Chuck thinks is going to happen, I think. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to our final news story of the evening. Hacked emergency alert system warns Brazilians of an unfolding alien invasion. Millions of Brazilians had a War of the Worlds moment over the weekend after the country's national emergency alert system sent them a message about an unfolding alien invasion. The bizarre incident reportedly occurred early Saturday morning at around 1:30 a.m. when the residents in several states were aroused from their sleep as their phones unexpectedly lit up with a rather troubling text. The message, mandating from the country's official emergency alert system, meant to warn weather-related concerns, was labeled extreme and obviously declared, protect yourself, alien attack, humans, we have arrived. Fortunately, because the message was sent when most of the recipients were asleep, the unsettling announcement of an aggressive alien arrival largely sparked bewilderment rather than panic, especially since there were no signs of any UFO on the attack. The following day, it was revealed that hackers somehow gained access to the system and sent several strange messages, including the extraterrestrials' missive that mystified millions. Though the public mostly made the light of the situation online, authorities were less amused, which rightfully so, stressing that the security breach exposed vulnerabilities in a system that needed to be addressed immediately before any further shenanigans occur. Hashtag panic stake.
Yeah, so it's hackers. There's no button that was ready to go.
No, there was no...
Saying there's an alien attack going on. Because remember this happened, not with alien attack, but Hawaii had that scare, I think, a while back ago where somebody accidentally sent out the missile warning.
Yes, the missile warning, but it wasn't a straight up saying, we've arrived,
yeah,
humans.
Yeah. But and that was just, you know, a false alarm. This was a hacker.
Yeah.
Trying to, the aliens. But, you know, we should have, I bet there is somewhere an actual alien alarm that would go off if case need be. There has to be one, right?
Yes, and I believe this topic interests Chuck, because Chuck is a big big proprietor and big interest in the Max Headroom incident. So somebody hacking over and taking over a message over something is definitely right up Chuck's alley. So ask Shaggy Chuck's take.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty common thing. People have hacked signs and, you know, hacked all sorts of EAS stuff to say, you know, zombies coming or what have you. So it's a pretty common thing. And you would think it's at some point they'd realize, hey, change the password from password 123. But who am I?
I don't want to give out WJLB's passwords, but we probably could. If you were put them together, probably. Yeah.
If we ever ended up with our own Max Headroom incident, it happened on my show.
I know, but, you know, we'll get Chuck to hack the hacker is what we'll do. In case something goes wrong, he'll hack into the hacking.
If somebody was to hack a show, I would say see them hacking Chuck's show.
Well, we could do that Monday mornings.
Chuck, how would you react if somebody hacked your show in the morning on a Monday morning?
We probably wouldn't even notice, to be honest.
It's a normal technology thing.
Yeah. We would just assume that somebody unplugged something and we weren't even on the air, but...
I don't know why I find that so humorous. Somebody hijacking WJLB's airwaves.
I'm sure it's, well, some
like it was actually more entertaining than the show that was on at the time.
Some say a while back, go.
Don't start.
Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into the lore of the week, which is something that happened right here in Northwest Indiana's backyard. So stick around. For podcast listeners, you're about to be hearing words from a podcast that you should be listening to. Stay tuned.
This is Mike.
This is Jacob.
And this is Matt.
We are Moth Boys,
a podcast on cryptids, conspiracies, and the unknown. You can catch us every other Monday on actually wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Thank you.
And we're back. Welcome,
yeah,
welcome.
It's been
back.
A while since we did that.
Yeah, it's been a hot minute since we've done a.
What happens in the episodes where there's guests? How do we?
I don't put a bumper in. All right. So this week we just kind of feeling it out and we're putting a bumper on the show. Yeah. So, Count, what'd you do during break?
Oh, see, during the break, Bob, I hacked into our own airwaves.
What'd you do?
It was unsuccessful.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Chuck, did you do anything interesting during break?
Mm-hmm. I had a drink and watched Tony try to hack, and then he just tripped over his own wires, and then that was that.
All right. So as of yesterday, it was the 108th anniversary of a tragedy that actually happened in Northwest Indiana, and I don't think that people realize that this incident, this tragic occurrence happened in Northwest Indiana, because most of the time for the story, people talk about the memorial in Forest Park, Illinois, one of Chicago's southwest suburbs. They talk about the Shulman's Rest Cemetery often, but they don't, you know, the actual crash site happened right here. So I want to talk a little bit about the Hammond train wreck of 1918 that killed scores of circus performers. I'm going to be reading an article written by Lorraine Bousinot from the Smithsonian Magazine. They wrote this back on June 2018, which would have been the 100th anniversary of it. So it's been 8 years since this article written. And then we'll dive in and we'll talk a little bit about it. Chuck's been Chuck was very knowledgeable on this and actually took us out yesterday, some of us from Northwest Indiana Paranormal. We'll talk about that. So let me read to you guys this article and tell you guys a little bit about the Hockenbeck Wallace Circus. Wasn't the largest show in the country, but it came really close. By 1918, the company employed around 250 performers, from acrobats to equestrians, clowns to lion tamers. Formed in 1907, when the circus owner Benjamin Wallace purchased the Carl Hockenbeck Circus, the outfit had since grown to be a $1 million extravaganza that required two separate trains of 28 cars each to transport all the performers, animals, and costumes and gear across the country. In fact, it was the trains that made such an enterprise possible. The enormous growth of railroads in the post-Civil War era fueled the golden age of circuses, writes historian Douglas Wissing. Instead of plodding through the mud at 10 miles a day from small town to small town, circuses hitched their rail cars to trains, then clattered from cities hundreds of miles apart overnight. By the turn of the 20th century, nearly 100 circuses roamed the United States, and more of a third of them traveled by rail. Circuses were an unmatched spectacle, bringing together a nation rapidly filling with new immigrants from different cultures and backgrounds. As culture historian Rodney Huey writes, the day the circus came to town was a holiday, disrupting the daily lives of its citizens. Often the point of that stores closed, factories shut down, schools' classes were dismissed. As for the Hockenbeck Wallace Circus, it was the nation's third largest circus and considered the Midwest version of the East Coast P.T. Barnum show. With the Hockenbeck Wallace show coming to the town, visitors could expect some of the most superbly trained animals, renowned trapeze artists, and breathtaking equestrian routines. Of course, traveling by train comes with its own risks. Railroad accidents of the era were more common and deadly. In 1892, when the circus was simply the Great Wallace Show, a railroad wreck resulted in 26 trained horses being killed. A second in 1903 occurred when the second train didn't slow down on its approach into the yard and slammed into the train ahead of it, killing 26 men and several animals, writes Richard Lytle in The Great Circus Train Wreck of 1918. But none of those accidents can compare to the scale and the disaster that the Hockenbeck Wallace team on June 22nd, 1918 occurred. The circus had just completed two performances in Michigan City, Indiana, and was traveling overnight the 45 miles to nearby Hammond. The first train, carrying workers and many circus animals, cruised on to its destination with no problems. But the engineers on the second train halted their progress to fix a hot box. The overheated axle bearing could cause a fire on a train if not dealt with immediately. It was around 4 a.m. when the second train pulled off onto the sidetrack, but the last five cars, including four wooden sleeper cars, remained on the main track. As the engineers worked and the performers slept, an empty train used to transport soldiers to the East Coast for subsequent deployment to the war front in Europe came barreling down the main track. The driver blew past several stop signals and then lamps of several of circus engineers trying to desperately stop the oncoming train. But the train's steel frame Pullman cars smashed into wooden circus coaches at speeds between 25 and 60 miles per hour, according to the newspaper reports of the time. The sound of the collision was so loud that nearby farmers awoke and hurried to see what happened. Henry Miller, the assistant light manager, was among the survivors, thrown from the wreckage with minor injuries. I was in the last coach next to the caboose and was asleep when we were hit, he told the Chicago Daily Tribune the day after the accident. I woke to the sound of splintering wood. Then there was another crash and another Then the train buckled on itself. It parted in the center as clean as thought as been sliced with a giant knife. How many people were killed or injured from the collision is impossible to say. In the moments after the impact, the kerosene lamps that hung in the hallways of the wooden cars quickly set everything aflame. Survivors clawed their way out of the debris or called for help before the fire engulfed them. Acrobat Eugene Enos, trapped beneath some wooden beams, received aid from his wife Mary and Lon Moore, a clown. "We pulled him clear just as the flames licked at him," Mary told the Chicago Tribune the next day. But most weren't so lucky. The fire spread so quickly that the crash survivors risked their own lives to pull friends and family out of the wreckage. Although the Gary and Hammond fire departments arrived as quickly as possible, the only source of water nearby was nearby shallow marshes. A wrecking crane also was brought in to the accident site to dig people out, but couldn't initially be used because of the heat from the fire was too intense. The Daily Gate City and Constitution Democrat, an Iowa newspaper, wrote later that day, "The tasks of identifying the dead and seriously injured were almost hopeless. Not only were many of the bodies burned so badly beyond recognition, but partially because everyone on the train was killed or hurt. More than 100 people were injured in the accident and 86 were killed, including some of the circus's famed performers. Animal trainer Millie Jewell, dubbed the Girl Without Fear, Jenny Ward Todd, an aerialist and member of the Flying Wards, bareback rider Luis Contrell, and Wild West writer Verna Connor, strongman brothers Arthur and Joseph Derricks, and the wife and two young sons of Chief Clown Joseph Coyle. In the aftermath of the accident, the families of the deceased performers struggled with who to blame. Was it the railway company, then engineer driving the empty train, a man named Alonzo Sargent, who was arrested and charged with manslaughter, the circus company itself? All of them seemed to shrink any to blame. One spokesperson for the Interstate Commerce Commission even released a statement to the Chicago Tribune saying, "We do everything we can to discourage the use of wooden cars on passenger trains and the use of substitution of steel ones. That's all we can do." As for the survivors, they decided the show must go on. Despite the tremendous and physical and psychological toll of the accident, the Hagenbach Wall Circus only missed two performances thanks to other circuses providing equipment and crew. In the following weeks, 53 of the deceased performers were officially buried in a large plot at Woodlawn Cemetery in Chicago, which just happened to be purchased by the Showman's League, a fraternal order created in 1913 to support men and women in show business. Only five victims had marked graves. The rest were burned too badly to be identified. And when the coffins arrived, more than 1,500 mourners gathered to pay their respects. The graves were memorialized with a stone elephant, its trunk drooping in sadness. In a way, tragedies like this could be fit with a popular view of a circus as a dangerous and slapdash workplace populated by shady transients and a natural prone to disaster, writes Stuart O'Nan in The Circus Fire, A True Story of American Tragedy. But most risks are painstakingly calculated by expert professionals as the rigid logistics behind the daily world of the circus. The problem was the risk couldn't be calculated when it was the unanticipated in the dead of the night. So Chuck and Count Panic and I and several members of Northwest Indiana Paranormal actually went out to the crash site yesterday. But Chuck, do we nail the story about correct there?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I think the main thing that we need to start with is just kind of talk a little bit about the history of railroading and railroading specifically Northwest Indiana. I always say, you know, this is the only place in the country where you can say, "Sorry, I'm late. I got caught by three trains on the way here," and you wouldn't be lying. So, yeah, I mean, this is the kind of place where, because of the growth of, you know, basically between Chicago and the East Coast, a lot of railroads located in this little area. So you had lots of railroads sort of crisscrossing, heading from Chicago to the East Coast. So we had all these train tracks, which we, you know, we still deal with to this day. Back in those days, railroading was very much it was still in its infancy. A lot of it relied on sort of person-to-person communications, humans in towers and relaying messages on paper and things like that. It wasn't nearly as automated and computerized, you know, obviously, as it is today. Everything was just sort of manual and everything was done by humans, and obviously humans make mistakes. So so that was sort of, I mean, the gist of your article was you've got the circus train. It's leaving Michigan City. It's heading to Hammond to put on a next show. The circus trains usually had two sections. The first section was the animals, and the second section was all the performers. The first section gets to Hammond. The second section's on its way to Hammond. And so there's sort of a point of contention here. Where it actually happened, the community was called Ivanhoe. And I always say Ivanhoe is currently a population zero because it was absorbed by Gary. So technically it happened in Gary. If you're looking for the site, the easiest way, you and I, we all took a little hike yesterday to get to it, but the easiest way to see it is if you're taking Klein Avenue, right before you get to sort of Fifth Avenue, you can look and see train tracks underneath you. And that's basically where it was. So essentially what happens is you have the second train. It's heading into Hammond. On the way there, it has a hot box, which a hot box is basically just, it's like an overheated brake or an overheated axle. They used to use grease and rags, and it was, again, sort of just a weird way of doing it, but it's how they kept their axles from catching fire. This one overheated, so they stopped. You have another train right behind it. And so one of the things about railroading is you had a lot of engineers that would fall asleep. They worked weird hours. That's the thing about railroading is, you know, they'll call you in the middle of the night and you have to come in. And so the engineer behind them had basically been awake all day. They said, you know, hop on a train in Michigan and head west. And so, you know, he knows that he's behind this other train. The circus train stops. He falls asleep and essentially blows through a couple signals and rear ends the train because his train was made up as an empty troop train. So it was made of heavy steel cars, and the Hagenbeck-Wallace train was wooden. So it literally just sliced through them like butter, tore the train apart. And trains in those days used kerosene lights and lanterns and coal-fired heaters and things like that. So when a train would derail, it would immediately catch fire. And that was one of the dangers of those wooden coaches, which is why they were originally, you know, they eventually were retired because of that fire risk. So not only did you have the accident itself, but then you had the aftermath, which was, you know, here you are, you're trapped, you're trapped in the wreckage, and then the train catches on fire, which was just a horrible way to go. And, you know, you have to, you know, think that there's all these people that were, you know, basically asleep at the time. And they get woken up by this crash, and, you know, they're getting thrown everywhere. It's dark, and now you've got fire to deal with. It was just, I mean, just a horrific scene that I couldn't even imagine. And because of its location, you know, and again, this was, you know, you didn't have the communications that we do today. So somebody had to call somebody else, call the fire department. They made their way over. It took hours for, you know, everybody to get there and start rescuing people. So it was just a, you know, horrific scene. And, you know, that's one of the reasons for me. I've been going out there since before the 100th anniversary. It was just such a horrible tragedy, and a lot of people didn't know about it. And it was something that I just kind of wanted to help, you know, educate people about it. And one of the goals for a lot of people was to get a memorial out there, which we saw yesterday. That was installed a few years ago. Again, it's just one of those things. It was a tragic story, and we just want those people, those victims, to be remembered.
And, the interesting thing is that the when we look at the case, like I was saying at the beginning of the lore here of the week, is that most people think about the disaster and they think about the Woodlawn Cemetery, which
to Showman's Rest,
but nobody ever thinks about the crash site itself. Which it's interesting to me that the plot of land was bought out in Chicago and not bought in Northwest Indiana. So they shipped all these bodies or what was left of them over to Forest Park just to kind of get them buried. The and there is there are some ghost stories attached to this. What's up, Count?
I believe we have a call coming in. So
All right. So let's pretend that the calling system works 100%.
Yeah, let's see if this holds up here. Let's see. I'm going to hit talk.
Caller on the air, hopefully.
What happens here. They put the phone line up and on. Hello, caller.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Hey, John. Thanks for calling in.
No, I could hear you, and Bob could hear you. Chuck, can you hear him?
I can, absolutely.
Wow. We're batting pretty good tonight.
Well, I didn't hear Chuck say anything, but you and Bob are kind of like sounding like you're way in the background somewhere. Like there's like a you're in the background
on the phone lines. You mean though?
Yeah.
Okay.
On the phone lines, but anyway. So you know, I wasn't really aware, in all honesty, aware of this circus train. I mean, I've heard of it, but I never. Until I listened to you, Bob, explain into detail, and Chuck expounding a little bit on that, you know, the severity and the tragedy, obviously, of what happened. So, you know, as I'm listening to it, I think one of the questions I had, Chuck answered. So the site that this took place in Gary, the railroad tracks are still visible?
Yes.
That they are.
Okay, I mean, are they still being used, or are they just there that never, I mean, are they obsolete now, or?
That is a question for Chuck to answer,
are the tracks still being used?
Chuck, those particular lines that the crash happened on, aren't the ones we walked yesterday aren't being used anymore, are they?
No, they're very much being used.
Well, that's good.
I can't hear anybody.
He can't hear him. So
yeah, we'll have to relay
the questions then, Chuck.
We'll have to relay the questions back. But Chuck did say that the railroad crossing is still being used.
Well,
so.
You know what? And John was on this tour years ago, the Richard Crow tour, where they went to the Showman's Rest and that cemetery there where they were laid to rest. But yeah, it's nice that they finally got a marker there in Gary.
Yeah, in Gary.
All right, Count.
Hello.
Hey, Count.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I can't hear anything what you guys are saying. So I'm just going to just relay that message to Chuck, and I'll just put the radio back on because I can't hear anything
better.
On the phone.
Well, thanks, John. We appreciate it.
All right. We'll drop that call right there.
Hopefully next week we'll have the phone lines working, folks.
Let me drop it. Okay, now we're good. Okay. Yeah, Chuck, that's something to put on a list as far as phone lines go.
The never-ending Chuck list of things to do around WJOB.
Checking with his face right now, yes. But you know what? We're doing pretty good.
Chuck's face says it all, everybody.
No, but I was saying, the Richard Crow tours, they did.
They took you to the Showman's Rest, though, right? They took you to the
Showman's
cemetery.
Rest. Yeah, we didn't.
Yeah,
go
so they would go to Showman's Rest, yeah. And one of the urban legends was on. You know, if you're there at midnight, you can hear some animals, and it turns out that they're just a few miles away from Brookfield Zoo. Yeah. So,
yeah,
I want to point out that also there wasn't reported animal death in the train car
Correct.
Accident.
Yeah, no, the animals were in the first train. So there's a lot of people. Even I was just looking at Facebook, and a guy's like, "Oh yeah, they buried the elephants next to the train tracks, and all like none of that happened." In
well,
fact, actually,
oh yeah, there's a, show off what you got there, Chuck.
No, actually, so we got this at the. I got this not too long ago. I saw this. And it really kind of hit me. It's a picture of some elephants walking next to train tracks with a steel mill in the background. And it's sort of, I don't know, I'd love to meet this artist someday
He's
and
local,
ask him
right?
about it. But it really, to me, it just sort of, as some sad elephants walking along the train tracks, it really reminded me of this this incident. So I scooped it up, and it'll go on my wall.
And to kind of go back to what John was saying there, the train tracks, because there's multiple tracks over there if you're about, but the train tracks this happened on, that we suspect this happened on, Chuck, are those still in operation?
Yeah, those are still in use. And I mean, again, our Facebook post, we got lit up by a couple of railroad people saying, "What are you guys doing on the train tracks?" So I would say, as you saw, you know, you can walk the trail that's back there. There's a nature trail. You can walk the trail along the tracks and, yeah, stay off the train tracks, but you can see it from the road there, so you can kind of see the spot. There's nothing really to see other than some train tracks. So you can get nearby, but I felt comfortable taking you guys back there. It's definitely not advised to go walk train tracks that you don't know anything about.
Dude. Don't try this at home, kids.
No, that was, I didn't realize those were active tracks that we were just yaying around.
Yeah, don't worry. I was paying attention.
That's good.
I wasn't going to fall asleep.
That's good. We were we went out there yesterday with a couple of members of Northwest Indiana Paranormal, and we had some equipment out there, and we were testing to see if we could get some kind of response from the actual crash site, something paranormal in response. We weren't out there super long with equipment. It's just kind of a... You can't be out there super long, apparently, because those are active railroad tracks. So you want to be out there quick and get it done. But there, if you wanted to investigate yourself, I would recommend checking around the sign up to the crossing, but don't go on the tracks yourself. But what's interesting is I was doing some research, and I came across this article that talked a little bit about the actual... crash site itself being haunted. And I'm going to quote this one here, and it says, "One gentleman who used to spend a lot of time train spotting in the area claims to have seen a figure of a man pacing back and forth at the train site right before, and then would disappear right after the site would end. Perhaps the long-gone spirit of Alonzo Sargent, wishing he could return to undo the damage." And there's an actual quote here. "I would come in the evenings to watch the commuter trains go by and sometimes stay to watch for other freight trains passing. And it was always just at twilight when it had gone dark that I would see this man appear. I never felt quite afraid or even think anything of it, even after I had seen him once or twice. While it was happening, I would think, I wonder if he lost something or what he's doing there. And it wouldn't be until he disappeared again that I would remember seeing the entity or the vision of what had, what have you. I haven't been out there in many years, but I still think about that sometimes. Others have recorded to be voices of from the accident scene, including one recording collected of a woman saying, 'Help them,' and another man voice whispering, 'Burning up.'" Friend of the show, J.C. Resitas, part of Heartland Hauntings, remembers recording a voice which he wasn't expecting. As he played back the recording at the accident site, he had to rewind it one or two times because it was perfectly clear, and I couldn't believe what I heard, and it just said, 'Boo.'" So, is the crash site actually haunted? I have no evidence of it. We didn't have any evidence of it. What I will say, though, is we had something interesting happen on the Spirit Box yesterday. I had the SB-11 out there, and the Spirit Box said, "Clear as day, Chuck and Spite," back to back. And so we're like, "Oh, Chuck, that new Chuck was here."
So it listens to my show, apparently. But no, and you actually did pick up a bunch of names on the Spirit Box on somebody else's device. Which is interesting. He was going to look into that a little bit, but yeah, so we were out there right around that same time, like you said, at dusk. But you know, historically railroad tracks have a lot of ghost stories attached to them, ghost lantern sites, ghost trains and things like that. So I mean, it's, you know, there's a long history of sort of paranormal and spectral sightings along train tracks and things like that. So
yes, we have a question as well from John here too. He asked Chuck. Oh, this is Chuck N. right here. Hold on, let me pull it up here. He says, "Chuck, why is this being this accident more publicized by our local media? Of course, on the anniversaries, and it was kind of right, Chuck. Maybe like 8 years ago for the 100th anniversary."
Right. So I was actually out there. I that was one of the things. So there's a guy that wrote the book that you guys had a copy of yesterday from a lands trustee. So he was from Hammond. He wrote the book probably 20 years ago. So it really, again, it's one of those things where, you know, pre-internet and stuff like that, there really, people didn't know about it. And then between the internet and the book, people started to find out about it. And people that knew about it said it's, you know, one of the greatest tragedies. he even mentions in the book, is that there was no memorial to them. So it was, that was one of the big pushes in the last few years to get some sort of a marker out there. So it's a state marker. But like I said, yeah, I was out there for the 100th anniversary. I went out there a couple times that day. I was out there, you know, literally at 4 a.m. 100 years later. And I came back out later in the day. They had a memorial set up, you know, wreath ceremony and stuff like that. So it's nice that 100 years later, we're still remembering, you know, the victims of the tragedy. And then here we are, you know, 108 years later, still talking about it. And it still gets talked about. So, I mean, again, that to me is the most important part, is that we don't forget. You know, one of the things I always say about tragedies like this is that, you know, whenever there's a tragedy, whether it's a train or a ship or like the Iroquois fire, there's lessons to be learned from it that, you know, even to this day, there's a reason. I always say, like with the Iroquois fire, people always ask, you know, why did doors swing outwards in buildings? Well, because of the Iroquois fire. You know, there's all these things. We always say that, you know, rules are written in blood. And so there's all these things like the railroads. The railroads were a very dangerous place, and this was a very dangerous time for railroads. And now, and because there were so many accidents, you know, they modernized and they made things safer. It's just like, you know, air travel or anything like that. It's much more safer because the lessons learned from these accidents.
Well, I want to bring up too, of course, you mentioned they got a very nice mile marker there now, in, you know, memory of that train wreck from 1918. But I like at the end here, it says, despite the wreck's magnitude, railroad safety was slow to improve.
Right.
Over time there, Chuck.
So again, I mean, you know, today we have a system very similar to what air travel uses, where they have transponders. So again, like here in 2026, you know, there's hardly any accidents because of, you know, all the lessons learned. Again, railroad accidents were so common back then. It was such a dangerous place. You know, railroading was a dangerous thing. People would, you know, regularly lose their lives, lose limbs, things like that. It was really dangerous to work on the railroad, and it became much safer, again, because of all these accidents. But, you know, everything railroad, the signaling, the brakes, you know, what we call PTC. I mean, everything came out of these frequent accidents, and it was always the same story. Either somebody fell asleep, you know, somebody missed a signal. And so a lot of these systems came out of like, hey, this, we got to stop this from happening. And now we have, you know, a super safe, again, there's no count panic. There's no excuse in 2026 for a train to run late in 2026 because of how safe
they are. Oh, no.
We apologize to the sponsor.
The train enthusiasts.
Well, I want to bring up by the way, Art chiming in. I saw a couple videos on YouTube about the Hammond Circus train wreck. Didn't realize it was so close to Roxana, about 4 miles away.
Yeah.
Pretty close there.
Yeah, like I said, basically Klein Avenue and Fifth Avenue, you know, as you go over Fifth Avenue on Klein, you just kind of look down the tracks and you'll see where it is. So, again, you have a pretty good vantage point of it from Klein Avenue if you're ever out that way. Like if you're heading north, you can just kind of look to your right before you hit Fifth Avenue and you'll see it
and
there.
And that mile marker is Michigan Street. Colfax Avenue, right?
Yes.
That mile marker is on Colfax. You'll see the sign there. What did happen, unless I missed something here, the conductor, of course, that was driving the train that hit the circus train, what became of that?
He was charged with manslaughter.
Right. So there was a hearing in Lake County. So let's see. So he and his firemen were both charged criminally in Lake County. The jury was deadlocked. There was a mistrial, and they declined to retry the case. So, again, it's like one of those things where this guy – this is one of the inherent problems with railroading is, you know, you'd be up all day. Like in this case, the guy gets up early and, you know, gets up early in the morning, and then, you know, 10 o'clock at night, they're calling him saying, hey, jump on a train and head to Chicago. It's like, man, I've been up all day. You know, again, this is so
really
a lot of the rules going back to the rules, whether it's an engineer, a truck driver, a pilot. Like that historically was one of the biggest problems is people would fall asleep and cause an accident. So, again, a lot of those rules about, you know, when you can operate a train or airplane or what have you came out of these constant situations where, you know, an engineer is falling asleep at the throttle and, you know, something bad happens.
I want to point out, too, especially as far as the the ghost stories are concerned, because this is, you know, at the end of the day, there are ghost stories attached to it. That's why we're talking about it. Obviously, with the crash site, with it being, you know, as tragic as it was, it doesn't surprise me if there is a haunting going on there. As far as if we spent a little bit more time doing investigative work, I could have had better answers for you. But Showman's Rest, a lot of the reasons why people believe it's haunted, and the reason why that some people believe that there's still restless spirits, is because a lot of the graves there, like I was saying in that article, they're not, and I was there for Mother's Day, so I've seen it in person. There's unmarked graves, so many of them lined up, because a lot of these people they weren't able to be identified because of the fires, and they didn't have identifications to kind of begin with. The circus route back in the day was a place where people anybody could kind of just vagrantly just jump on and start working. So, you know, you might go and see the gravestone, and there might just be a gravestone there named Baldy, and that's just because that's what the person's name was, or just unnamed performer, and they gave, you know, passed away date. It's a lot of unfinished business and a lot of sad endings there, just to know that you couldn't, despite us having Showman's Rest and despite us having this memorial service there, it's still sad that we have so many as unmarked graves and whatnot. So if there is a haunting going on there, that's what I would assume was going on. But as far as the animals are concerned, if you're out there hearing animals, well, Brookfield Zoo, if you ask my mother's like, no, they're not. They're hearing the circus animals, but well, the circus animals died. So I don't know. Maybe that's
right. But yeah, to your point, though, I mean, that's the thing about the circus in those days is, you know, that old saying, I'm going to run away and join the circus, was, I mean, that's what people did. They got themselves in trouble or whatever. They would just kind of, you know, leave their life and just kind of join the circus. And in those days, you can just kind of say, hey, I'm Baldy or I'm Smiley. And you know, that was it. You didn't have to have a driver's license and a social security card to get a job. And you can kind of do that. And so that was the thing, was a lot of these people, joining the circus was basically a way to get away from something. So for a lot of those people, maybe they had unfinished business with a family member or whatever. They left their family. They left a bad situation, joined the circus. And then, you know, nobody really knew who they were. And then you have this tragic accident and you couldn't identify them. So of the, you know, most of the people that were buried were unidentified because of how horrific it was. And so you're right. I mean, you've got a lot of just sort of restless spirits and, you know, unmarked graves and things like that. So I'd say, like, this is this story of any is one of just a lot of, you know, like I said, just sort of unfinished business.
Absolutely. I got to give a shout out to South Shore Steph. She's chiming in. She's listening to the show.
Yeah.
Hello, South Shore Steph. She was busy yesterday, but she would have been out there if she was around, because, you know.
Oh, so she was running late, too, just like the other South Shore.
The trains. Well, yeah. Yeah. And speaking of the trains, Art chiming in. Today, train crews can't work longer than 12 hours at a time. The train must stop wherever it is, and a new crew will be driven out to the engine, and the old crew will be picked up. And I think they stop here right on the boulevard to change those crews every single time.
Whenever you're running late, they always stop right there. But yeah, again, like to Art's point, I mean, again, a lot of these rules were written in blood, because it was a very common thing for engineers to have. That was the way that the railroad worked, is they just call you in the middle of the night. You could have just gone to sleep. They call you and say, get up, go run this train, and you hadn't slept all day. So, you know, a lot of those rules, like I said, for railroads, truck drivers, pilots, all came out of that, you know, that human thing where, you know, eventually you're going to fall asleep where you are.
Radio
show. If you've been up all day.
No, we're young.
Podcasters.
Podcast and radio hosts. We don't have a... Luckily, we're not... If we're too tired, we just kind of mumble sometimes.
Oh, fall asleep on the air there.
No, but Chuck, I want to appreciate you taking time out of your evening to jump on and join us today.
No, absolutely. Like I said, I mean, to me, this is sort of you know, growing up in this area and learning about this, it's a real honor for me to share this story with other people because, again, it was such a tragic story that happened literally in some of our backyards. And, you know, it's nice to kind of just take a moment. I try to do that every year. Just take a few moments and remember the victims of this horrible tragedy. And again, you know, talk about what we can learn, the lessons that we can learn from things like this.
What's up, Count?
Go ahead.
Oh, what were you going to say? You look like me.
I
thought you were going to say something.
Well, I was going to say, are you going to ask Chuck your closing question?
Usually? Oh, yeah, Chuck. So
he's a correspondent.
We're still going to make him do it. And I'm afraid of what's going to be the answer. So, Chuck, what we do here on the show to finish up with our guests is these days we make them end with a quip or a joke or a riddle or something. So it could be as simple as telling the fans don't play with matches, but
something inspirational.
Something inspirational from Chuck Boland. What's that?
You brought this on yourself. How much time we got? No, I mean, again, like I said, I always appreciate this is a lot different from my usual, my morning political show on Monday mornings here in WGOB. And again, it just, I don't necessarily have a good quip or joke or anything like that. But, thanks for having me on. Okay. And
Favorite phrases you like to sprout up, but maybe this is not the show for them.
I mean, I could end with taxation is theft if you'd like.
There we go.
He said the words. All right, folks. Kyle, do you have any closing words for our audience this evening?
No, I can't top that one.
All right. Folks, thank you for watching and listening to another episode of Bob After Dark. On behalf of myself, Count Panic, and Chuck, we just want to say goodnight to all of you. My mom, sweet dreams, and my dad, wherever you are in the universe, I hope you're happy, comfortable doing whatever it is that you want to be doing. And the Tiff, I hope you have the sweetest dreams of them all. Good night, everybody. Remember, the two most important rules of Bob After Dark are not all who wander are lost, and as above, so below. Until next time.
Memoriam Development.